Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your high school reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me for this international edition is co-host Darren Husted.
Hello. Hello there, John.
Darren was actually on the very first episode of Sophomore Lit, doing the reading for Lord of the Flies. Darren, could you tell a little bit about yourself and where people might have heard you?
I'm guessing that people would have heard me first on a talking cast, because I was the producer and editor of that, which I should explain was a minute-by-minute podcast about the film A Talking Cat, of which you were a guest on a few episodes. And then I decided to talk about The Boy Next Door minute-by-minute, and currently I'm finishing up a minute-by-minute podcast about Clueless. So I guess if you've listened to any of those podcasts, you would have heard my voice there.
This episode, I mentioned, is an international episode. This time we are doing Richard Sheridan's 1775, or produced originally in 1776, play The Rivals.
Yeah.
Which is not a play I have ever read, although I was, of course, familiar with the most famous character from this play, Mrs. Malaprop. And we'll get into that. But Darren, you wanted to do this episode, and can you talk a little bit about your history with this play?
Absolutely. For my English literature A-levels, we did a number of different texts. We did a couple of poets. We did Emma by Jane Austen, which has proved, you know, helpful for analyzing Clueless minute by minute. We obviously did a couple of Shakespeare plays, because you know, everyone has to do Shakespeare, and everyone hates doing Shakespeare in English schools. And this was one of the other texts that our teacher got to choose, because the way it works is there's like a list of different texts that each, you know, that you're allowed to do, and then the teachers kind of pick and choose which ones they want to teach us. And The Rivals was one of those that we did. And when I was studying this, there was actually a touring company doing this play, and Mrs. Malaprop was played by Patricia Routledge, who might be known to some people as Hyacinth Bouquet from Keeping Up Appearances. So it was kind of lucky that just as we started studying it, that company was doing this, and it happened to be, you know, in my town. And this is a play, I will say, that really lives on the stage. Like, you can read it, and it's an amusing read, but I think it's best to see it performed. And particularly if you've got people who kind of, you know how to really get into kind of the language and the kind of, I guess I would say, witty dialogue. There's a lot of back and forth between tons of characters, and that's kind of... So, yeah, so I studied it for A-level, I got a C on my English A level, so I don't know how qualified that makes me to speak about it. But it was out of the stuff that we studied, it was possibly my favorite, certainly of the plays that we did.
In America, I was saying, typically American students will study, of course, a Shakespeare play or a couple of Shakespeare plays in high school. And then if they do anything else in English drama, they will probably skip ahead to, say, Oscar Wilde or something like that, or in the late 19th century, the Victorians. They will completely skip over the intervening, oh my God, how many years? So Shakespeare...
I mean, it's from 1610.
1610, right, yeah.
So, yeah, you're probably looking at a jump of about 200 years. Considering you're in a country that's only 230 something years old, that's quite a chunk of history to miss out there.
And quite a bit happens in your country during that time, including, of course, a civil war.
Yeah.
And the restoration of the monarchy. Now, Interestingly enough, though, that Civil War and did disrupt theater in England for a good deal of time there. The Roundheads were kind of a dour lot and did not take kindly to most theatrics. And it was actually the Restoration comedies, which come right before this play, that have kind of the reputation of being among the most bawdy of English dramas.
I think by their second peak, they were basically just people copulating on stage. Like that was that. And I'm going to say, like for part of the A level, we did like you know, we didn't do much in detail, but we did kind of do a tiny bit about kind of Restoration comedy. And because I also studied Hamlet at A level, we did a lot about like the revenge plays, kind of leading into Shakespeare. So there was kind of we got a kind of small history of kind of plays. But you're right, once the Puritans were in charge of this country, they banned everything. And as is always taught in English schools, they banned Christmas, which seems to be the argument for keeping a monarchy, which seems weird, but I guess you know, that's one way of selling it. But yeah, so yeah, Restoration comedy kind of came into fashion, I mean, actually kind of about 100 years before this play. And then it kind of had, it was about 10 or 20 years of it kind of filling every single place where people would just go and watch these plays, which were basically, I mean, they satirized heavily the upper classes. You know, everyone had mistresses, everyone was having sex with everyone. And then people kind of got bored of that, and then they kind of went back to it a little bit. And then after about 40 or 50 years of that, it kind of died out a little bit.
Well, there was the Licensing Act, it was called, of 1743, which was what brought about official censorship in Great Britain, and that wasn't actually challenged until the 1960s, or completely repealed until the 1960s. And that was mostly to try and keep the comedies from making too much fun of the government. I think the government was very skittish in the early 18th century. They had just come through a civil war, and they didn't want there to be more unrest. But also, they were kind of thin-skinned.
Yeah, and it's also important to remember that, like, the position of Prime Minister, as we understand it now, is only really about 100 years old. You know, these days it has to be someone from the House of Commons, it has to be an MP. You know, there's kind of certain conditions to it, whereas, you know, the Prime Minister, when it first came about, you know, under George I, was kind of, it was just someone that the king favoured, basically, and put in charge of the government, and kind of someone that they felt they could control. And obviously that's an area that would be ripe for satire if essentially the king is just putting a puppet in place. You know, and again, I mean, you, at this particular time as well, this is just as the House of Hanover had come into power. So you had kings who basically couldn't speak English, you know. So there was a lot of stuff to make fun of, and there was a lot of opportunity to do that. And like you say, yeah, this act stood for about 200 years before someone was like, you know, why aren't we allowed to say whatever we want inside a theatre? Because a lot of other areas had already kind of challenged censorship a little bit. I mean, the funny thing is that this kind of level of censorship essentially would stay in the form of like the BBFC and various other kind of like acts where stuff that was on video was subject to very heavy censorship. And obviously in the 80s, there was the whole video nasties thing where lots of horror films that were freely available in other countries were not shown here. And, you know, so there's always been a kind of level of censorship that the government wielded. These days, you know, the BBFC is very kind of liberal and they'll kind of let almost anything through, which is, of course, what they now get criticised for rather than censoring. But yeah, the idea that you had to please the Lord Chamberlain so that you could put your play on is such a weird notion. And yet for 200 years, people are like, well, that seems reasonable.
The play that I read from this period that it still, I think, gets taught in America is She Stoops to Conquer, which I think... Goldsmith is kind of held in a kind of a higher regard as a stylist. And both that and this play, The Rivals, are plays that they hold over from the earlier comedy of manners a kind of a preoccupation with class, and particularly with people from one class being treated like members of another class. But they are much gentler plays. They're much, I don't think you could really object to much that goes on in this play. And it's quite telling that this play was actually a favorite of George Washington's when it was performed in America. So sort of like Marlene Dietrich was a favorite of both the Americans and the Germans during World War II, this play was both a favorite of Washington's and George III's. I didn't know much about Sheridan before I read up on this, but I was kind of fascinated by the story of how this play came to be, because it was not a hit right away.
No, Sheridan is quite interesting because he was mostly an MP for most of his career. He was elected about 5 years after this play came out, and he spent like almost 30 years in Parliament. And, you know, he was, if you were to take a look at his life, he was mostly a member of Parliament. That was kind of how he made his money, and that was how he had a living. And he literally only wrote this play because he desperately needed money. And I guess it was the time where anyone could just write a play and put it on and make some money. But yeah, no, his life is fascinating because, like, and it's something that's reflected within this play, which is like the main theme of this play is kind of like, should you marry for love or should you marry for money? And Sheridan himself essentially married for love, and that meant he had no money. He married an actress, and once they were married, you know, he was looked down upon as being of a lower status because people, you know, actors weren't held in high regard at the time. And so he ended up kind of giving up a substantial amount of money from his family to marry this woman. And, you know, the only reason to write the play was to get some money as quickly as he possibly could. But yeah, it was a huge failure. And that was down to the stereotyping of Sir Lucius O'Trigger, which apparently the actor who played him was basically mocking Irish people, and it did not go down well.
Now, Sheridan himself was of Irish stock, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I think that there's a long tradition of these great Irish authors that everyone thinks of as English, like him, like Wilde or Swift. I doubt it exists, but I would love to see what the first draft of this looked like, because in a way, Trigger kind of becomes fairly inoffensive in the final draft here. His characteristic is that he's the one who goads Bob Akers into dueling at the end, and the humor from his scenes comes from the fact that he blandly understates the what the possible results of a duel might be.
Yeah, it's funny because his character, I believe he refers to himself as a country gentleman, which is kind of like a euphemism for saying that he's uneducated. But the fact that it's weird because he calls himself that, but the audience is supposed to know that, oh, well, that just means he's stupid, basically. And you know, that's kind of, he's basically a country bumpkin, but he thinks of himself as a gentleman, which, you know, who and who is not a gentleman in this play is quite an important matter.
I just want to mention briefly that this play takes place in Bath, which is amusing to me because I had in college, when I went to stay in the UK for a trimester, I had one of the greatest afternoons of my life walking around Bath with a friend of mine who had a video camera. Now, this was in like 1989, I believe, and ownership of a video camera was still something of an oddity. And so my friend, who was able to pull this off with a very straight face, was going around telling people that he was there shooting a documentary on Bath and asking people to give their ruminations on the city. And one gentleman who had obviously been waiting all his life to be on a BBC Three documentary he's just kind of like turned off, like looked into the deep into the rise, and he said, "Bath is, I believe, the most architecturally significant of all English cities. Its great buildings running the gamut as they do from the Roman remains to the terraced Georgian townhouses of the Royal Crescent." I wish I had the video now, but it was a great memory of mine. Bath is, of course, where there was a natural spring, that's where it gets its name from. And at this time, it was kind of a resort town. It was a place where people went to take in the water cure, but it was also kind of a place where lots of people come and go. And none of the people in this play are from Bath.
Yeah, I mean, taking the waters was kind of the reason for going to Bath at this particular time. And it was something that, like, you know, the wealthy did. They would go to Bath for the weekend, then they would go back home. And yeah, it was essentially like a city full of tourists, at a time when kind of tourism as a thing didn't really exist. And I think it fell out of favor relatively quickly, kind of like by the time you get to, you know, like 18 something, like people just stopped going there.
If you go to Bath today, the most interesting place from a historic standpoint is this Royal Crescent, where there are all these great Georgian townhouses. And that, I think, is sort of the remnants of this period. And I think it's important to this play because it is a play, as you said, where a lot of the concerns are about who is a gentleman and who isn't a gentleman, and what it even means to be a gentleman. It's kind of like if you set something today in, say, the Riviera, or if you set something in like a film festival up in the mountains somewhere, you know, it's kind of a place where a lot of different kinds of people can come together.
You have like the Abbey in Bath, which is, you know, hundreds of years old. There'd been battles fought in Bath, you know, like it's a city that had a lot of history, even by, you know, the 1700s. And kind of the kind of turnover of people coming in and out of the city, particularly at this time, you know, was quite important for its economy. So obviously you wouldn't really want to write a play that offended the visitors, particularly the wealthy visitors to the city.
The play opens with this kind of introductory sequence that's actually written in rhymed iambic pentameter. It's sort of like Sheridan's trying to show off that he can do it. It's a kind of an odd little vignette in which the conceit is that the audience are members of a jury at a court of law where they're going to pass sentence on the worth of the play they're about to see. If you go online to YouTube and watch the 2004 Old Vic production, which I recommend anyone who's interested in this play do, because it's a pretty good production. It's a good production to see, but they completely omit this, and I can understand why. It doesn't really, it's more of a, I don't know, it seems to me like a kind of an antiquated thing, even for the time. You know, certainly the formalism of it trying to kind of recall something Shakespearean, but I did kind of wonder if this whole audience pass your judgment thing was Sheridan telling his audience, here, give it another try now that I've rewritten this play.
Yeah, it's worth noting that for the first kind of like 2 weeks of performance, it was, the play was slightly different, and it was hastily kind of rewritten, and then this prologue was added, as you say, kind of like a Sheridan saying, look, the play might have been bad before, but give it a try now and see if you like this version. And of course, it concludes with, I think, is it Lucy who kind of says to the audience, you know, did you think it was that bad? Nah, it wasn't really that bad, was it? And it kind of, so it's weird because, like you said, the version that's on YouTube, that it kind of omits the prologue, but it gives the little bit of the epilogue. So, you know, if you had never studied the play or read it, you would be wondering what was going on at the end. But, you know, the ending, well, when we get to the ending, we'll talk about it. But yeah, the play just kind of stops, so it's not really that much of an issue.
This has one of these farcical plots that relies a lot upon characters knowing things that other characters don't know, and people making mistakes about identity, and there's just a lot of kind of stage work, and it's one of those things that can be a little confusing to read. If you just read it, it makes perfect sense when you see it on the stage. So bear with us as we go through the plot, because it's a little convoluted, and we may end up saying, oh yeah, the thing we left out two scenes ago was this. So it opens in Bath, and it opens with the servants of Admiral Absolute, who is the father of Jack Absolute, who is kind of one of the main romantic leads. And so it's a meeting between the two servants of the Absolutes, and it's kind of an information dump.
I should say as well, online there are some places that omit to say the name of one of the servants.
Oh yeah,
because his name is his name is Fag, and this obviously to English audiences, you know, that would not be considered that offensive a word, but I think it's a play on the public school practice of fagging, which is when you would have younger boys, particularly in places like Eton, would do your bidding. If you were a sixth former, then, you know, like the 11, 12-year-olds would, you know, shine your shoes and iron your shirts and various things like that. So, it's, you know, there's something that Sheridan does here, which is every, like, kind of almost like Dickensian in his naming schemes, like the fact that someone's called Absolute, the fact that someone's called Languish, like... He uses names in a very specific way, and he's doing that with Fag. But yeah, like Fag and I think, is it David or is it
Thomas?
Thomas, yeah. The other, I think Thomas is only in this scene, and then he's not really seen for the rest of the play. But yeah, they're kind of discussing, you know, that you know, Jack is in town, and just kind of talking about what he's doing in Bath. I'm trying to think of what else is said in that scene.
Fag explains to Thomas the main plot point for that. That's the motivating plot point, which is that his master Jack is wooing this young woman, Lydia Languish.
Yeah.
But because Lydia is so smitten with ideas of romance, and you know, she's kind of like a little Don Quixote. All she does is sit around and read books of romance all day. That he has been wooing her in the form of, what's the name, Beverly?
Ensign Beverly.
Ensign Beverly.
Yeah, his rank is very important because he's Captain Jack Absolute, but he's Ensign Beverly. Even the fact that he's taken a lower commission is a sign that he, you know, he's got less money, basically.
This is an important point because the rest of the play kind of depends on that you get this. And I think that a modern playwright wouldn't drop this kind of information in a conversation between two characters who aren't the characters that are being talked about. But I think it speaks to a different kind of an audience that they're being situated into this play, because once we hit the ground running, we have to understand that Jack has presented himself to Lydia as Ensign Beverly, and Lydia has fallen in love with him as Ensign Beverly.
Yeah.
And if you don't catch that now, you're going to be very confused when you get to the scene with them.
Yeah, I think it doesn't... I can't remember if it's Fag or... we must be Fag, because he says that Lydia Languish is a lady of very singular taste, which is obviously kind of hinting that she specifically is looking for someone poor to marry. But yeah, it's a weird setup just to have these two kind of servants talking about the whole kind of situation. Although it does help you, because obviously Fag is playing along with the setup in a little way, and he's also helping, you know, along with Lucy, he's helping pass messages back and forth as Beverly, and helping kind of hide the Absolute identity.
Lucy is Lydia's maidservant. One thing that I think is set up here too is that Fag, he likes the intrigue and he likes the lying. There's a later scene where he's talking to Jack, and Jack says, why are you making this more complicated than it has to be? And he says, well, I find that it helps to embellish a lie with a lie. As you say, not just with the namings of the characters, each character gets kind of a defining trait about them. Admiral Sir Anthony Absolute, sorry, the father. I grew up in America where we don't have all these titles. But Sir Anthony Absolute he's the guy who's going to put his foot down. He will allow no dissension from his ranks or from his son. And at the slightest sign of insubordination, that's when he goes crazy. So that's his defining trait. I think Fagg's defining trait is that he likes to lie and he likes to gossip.
I don't think this is completely reflected in this play, but certainly it's something that a lot of authors like to do with servants, which is obviously within a household, whoever is the highest ranked member of the household, if you are the servant of that, the highest ranked member, then you are the highest ranked servant. And so because Fagg is the, you know, he's works for Sir Anthony, he is essentially the highest ranking in his household. So he acts the same way. He acts as though he's kind of better than other servants, and, you know, as if he's closer to being a gentleman than other servants are. Which is funny because, you know, obviously no one upstairs would really be that concerned with how he acts.
We then switch from here to a scene between Lydia Languish, the young woman that Jack has been courting, and she is under the protection of Mrs. Malaprop. I don't know that they're related. She's more kind of a ward.
Yeah, because I don't think she's not Julia's mother and she's not Lydia's mother. So I think it is just that she's in charge of the Languish household. And she's possibly like an old maid who's kind of just been put in charge of
Well, these girls. She's a Mrs., so she's a widow.
Yeah.
But of course, Mrs. Malaprop is the character from which we get the word malapropism. And that's kind of her function in the play, is to provide comedy. And she does. She's very funny. She's constantly there to misspeak words, quite bewilderingly sometimes. Sometimes I had to sit there for a while and try to go over in my head what it was that she actually meant to say.
I guess if you're English, some of the phrases that she's using, you can easily hear what she's misinterpreting. So, but I guess if you're not English, some of the things that she says, because of the way that Sheridan has changed them, you end up having to try and figure out what she was attempting to say, and then what he's changed it to, and then so it does require a bit of work. But yeah, she like almost every sentence that she says, she will say a word that's too long.
I would by no means wish a daughter of mine to be a progeny of learning. I don't think so much learning becomes a young woman. For instance, I would never let her meddle with Greek or Hebrew or algebra or simony or fluxions or paradoxes or such inflammatory branches of learning. Neither would it be necessary for her to handle any of your mathematical, astronomical, diabolical instruments. But, Sir Anthony, I would send her, at 9 years old, to a boarding school in order to learn a little ingenuity and artifice. Then, sir, she should have supercilious knowledge in accounts. And as she grew up, I would have her instructed in geometry, that she might know something of the contagious countries. But above all, Sir Anthony, she should be mistress of orthodoxy, that she might not misspell and mispronounce words so shamefully as girls usually do, and likewise that she might reprehend the true meaning of what she is saying. This, Sir Anthony, is what I would have a woman know, and I don't think there is a superstitious article in it.
And this is Sheridan kind of poking fun. I don't think like the landed gentry, but certainly like the newly rich, like people who through marriage or have managed to get into the, you know, managed to improve their station a little bit or get into a higher class, but they don't quite know how to behave. So she will say stuff like, you know, he's the very pineapple of politeness, and oh, it gives me such hydrostatics to a degree, and just weird stuff like that. And everyone around her kind of just, they never ever bother to correct her, and they it's almost as if they've gotten used to it. Although some of the kind of newer characters do occasionally, depending which version of, you know, depending which stage play you watch, they will always be throwing looks out to the audiences as to say, look at this person who doesn't understand what she's talking about half the time.
In this scene, we have Lydia, we have her friend Julia.
Julia's actually her cousin.
Oh, her cousin, yeah. Right.
I don't think that's completely made clear in the play, but I think in the character notes, it's made clear that they're cousins.
Both of them are carrying on romantic affairs. Lydia, as we've mentioned, has fallen in love with the fictional Ensign Beverly, and Julia has a suitor named Falkland, who we don't see him much. We were told that they're given to kind of quarreling. Falkland, when he appears, you will get a lot of his character. Julia, I'm afraid, doesn't get much of a character trait. She's just kind of there to be long suffering with Falkland. Did you get a sense of her as a character at all? I mean,
yeah, I mean, I guess she's supposed to be like she's obviously like a counterpoint to Lydia, but she's kind of too similar, really. Like whereas Absolute is kind of a bit more, he's the cleverest person in the play. He knows everything that's going on, and whenever anyone tells him stuff, he knows how to, you know, react to the situation. Whereas Falkland, once you meet him, is very sentimental and very kind of driven to passion. And I think kind of Julia is meant to be that, but Lydia is kind of almost exactly the same. So it's, yeah, there's not, I guess it just depends on how it's played on stage. It's sometimes hard to figure out which one is which, apart from the fact that Lydia gets more lines. You know, like, you, if you were to swap their lines around, you wouldn't really be able to tell that the characters were that different. I think there's some funny stuff when they start talking about how Lydia has got into a quarrel with Beverly that she only meant to last, 3 days, and it's ended up lasting 10 days because, you know, that she couldn't get a note to him. And like, it's like this kind of this weird thing where she's very much into staging what she sees as a romantic relationship, which includes having quarrels of fixed length so that they can be resolved romantically. And Julia isn't prone to that. Julia just really wants to be with Falkland. So I guess she's less false, I guess would be the best way to describe Julia. But like you say, not really much of a character aside from being a love interest for Falkland.
It's interesting what you say about Lydia not being able to get a letter out. Hasn't she been like confined? Has she been confined to her rooms by Mrs. Malaprop or something like that?
Yeah, yeah. She's essentially, as the play begins, she's under house arrest by Mrs. Right. Malaprop. She won't let her leave, which is why when Lucy enters with all the books, and there's quite a funny scene where Lydia has, like, read off all the different titles of the books that she's got from the local library, and there's like a huge stack of all these different romance novels, and when they hear that Mrs. Malaprop has come in, they start throwing them around the set, like hiding them under chairs, hiding them under pillows, and they keep, you know, reciting all the different names, you know. But yeah, she's basically confined to the house and she cannot leave. And it remains that way for almost the entire play. I think until we get to the duel in the field, she's basically always in the same room, which I think helps because the plot has kind of so many different little kind of twists and bits for you to remember, that the fact that you, whenever you see Lydia, she's always in the same place.
She's relying on her maidservant Lucy to take out letters. Now, this is being a 18th century work of literature. If you read a lot of 18th century and 19th century English literature, it seems to me like everyone is always communicating via letter. And I realize that, you know, what of course you're not seeing here is the poor maidservant or the poor, footman who has to go walk the 5 miles or whatever to take this note over to the next house over. But the fact that things take place in this world of letters is what makes possible the other plot line that is introduced here, which is that Mrs. Malaprop has also been carrying on a relationship with a Sir Lucius Atrigger, which the character we mentioned before, who had had to be rewritten for this version of the play, and they apparently have not met. You know, it's left a kind of an open question how this chain of letters even started.
Yeah, and not only have they not met, but at the other end, Sir Lucius Atrigger does not realize that he is not corresponding, like he's corresponding with Mrs. Malaprop. She's signing her letters Delia. And he is under the impression, I think it's somewhere throughout the play, it's intimated that he's seen Lydia with Lucy. And so he thinks he's corresponding with Lydia. And Lucy is taking money from Sir Lucius Atrigger to give the letters to him. and she's also taking money from Mrs. Malaprop to take the letters back. So she, you know, she's making money out of both of them. And that's what finishes the second scene in the first act, is Lucy standing on stage explaining that Lucius O'Trigger thinks he's corresponding with a beautiful young girl when he's actually corresponding with Mrs. Malaprop. And how much, and she keeps telling us how much money she's making for each delivery.
This is another one of those things that I think mark this period. In these days, we're all taught again to show, don't tell. And basically Lucy is going to tell us everything that's going on. And it's fairly crucial information, again, for understanding the rest of the play. So you better pay attention to this speech she delivers here.
It's funny because I don't think the Sir Lucius Trigger storyline, kind of that the Delia stuff, doesn't really come into play until almost near the end of the play. So
right.
Once you've listened to Lucy deliver this, it's almost like an hour and a half before you'll be reminded that, oh yeah, she's also been doing this on the side. but this also kind of, Lucy, when she's talking with Lydia and when she's talking with Julia and Mrs. Malaprop, she acts in a very specific way where she acts like less intelligent, I would say. Like she acts, you know, like they are better than her. And then once they're all off stage and she's alone, she kind of drops this facade and is kind of like, look, I know what I'm doing. You know, although I'm running around town delivering letters, I'm making money out of this enterprise, and they are all fools. And I think this is the thing that would have appealed to the audience back in 1775, 1776, is the idea that, particularly, you know, as theatre would have attracted, you know, every type of person to the theatre. And so you would have the kind of upper classes being like, well, you know, our servants aren't that terrible. And you would have had the servants being like, well, yeah, we're better than our masters. So it's funny how Sheridan is using Lucy here to kind of play to the entire audience and be like, look, she knows what she's doing and she's better than everybody else. And, you know, that's why you, the viewer, are also better than Lydia and better than Julia and, you know, better than these people who are going around doing silly things, basically.
The next act opens with Fagg talking with Jack, and there's a lot more kind of discussing the situation they're in. And then in comes Jack's pal Falkland. Now, Falkland is the guy who's having this relationship with Julia. And Falkland's main characteristic is that he's so insecure, he has to test Julia's devotion to him, and he becomes incensed to find that in his absence, Julia has been out dancing and carrying on as though he's not around. The old Vic production kind of plays Falkland like almost sort of like a parody of a Byronic hero, and that he's like given over to these great moods. I think you could go different ways with this character. I think that's a good way to go with him. But I think the main point that's on the page is that he is just desperately insecure, and he has this idea that Julia needs to demonstrate his love to her through these tests that he's going to set up for her.
Whereas Jack is kind of playing, he knows exactly what Lydia wants. Therefore, he's being Ensign Beverly to get her affection. Falkland already has Julia's affection, but he has kind of no idea how to keep it. So he always feels like he's always kind of like, it's almost as if she's always on the verge of breaking up with him. So he's kind of got to keep trying things to make her stay. And he'll do that later on in the play with kind of almost disastrous circumstances. You know, where he'll kind of decide that he's going to duel someone just on the hint that they may think they like her. And it's kind of almost a little bit ridiculous. There is a thing throughout this play. Obviously, at this particular time, dueling was illegal. And there is the kind of the way that the duels are set up throughout the play and that they kind of pay off at the end is a parody of how dueling was done in other plays. Like, dueling was a common way for a play to finish with, you know, two men fighting over a woman's honor. And so Sheridan kind of seems to think that's a bit of a ridiculous thing to do. And so he's kind of setting Falkland up as the person who will kind of show how ridiculous it is to be constantly trying to fight for women in this manner.
Now, the other character who shows up right now is our last major character, Bob Acres, who is a country gentleman. The old Vic production plays him as Cornish, I believe, in the accent. Is this something you would read from the... Can you read that in the dialogue, or is that just a choice that the author made?
I think that was just a choice that was made by that particular production. I mean, obviously, you know, Somerset is close to Cornwall. It's kind of in that region. So there is a kind of a rivalry between those counties and in that area. So like putting that accent on, certainly when this play was, you know, first performed, having an accent that was from a nearby region would have been a sign of someone being less intelligent. Kind of like if you were putting a play on in London, if you have someone with like a Mancunian accent, well then that character must be stupid because they're not from London.
As an outsider to all the British Isles many accents, and someone who just kind of like gets my exposure to this from Masterpiece Theatre, it always seemed to me like Cornwall was the go-to place for if you wanted to write a country bumpkin in English literature. I mean, certainly in modern times you have things like Doc Martin set in Cornwall, where there's supposed to be a lot of hilarity between the manners of a polished doctor from London and from all the fisher folk out in Cornwall. But tell me, is that the case? I mean, it always seemed to me like there was a kind of a cliche in the way that, like, say in America, if you wanted to have a cliched country bumpkin, you would give him, say, a Texas accent.
Yeah, except I'd say Cornwall is closer to like Alabama.
Uh-huh.
Like it's kind of there's not like a one for one there, but yeah, like you know, because you know Somerset has like, you know, like Bath, you know, has like you know a few cities. Cornwall is mostly farmers, it's mostly farmland, so if you were someone with money and you were in Cornwall, that just meant that you owned a lot of land, but also that you were most likely just a farmer. So you weren't going to have like a huge country house. You were just going to have like a little farm in the middle of thousands of acres. So yeah, like Cornwall, there is a comedian who allegedly is the favorite comedian of Prince Charles, and he goes by the name Jethro, and he's basically. If you ever want to hear like a really thick Cornwall accent, then just like look up some of his videos, and his entire kind of humor derives from the fact that he's from Cornwall, basically, and that his voice sounds stupid. But yeah, so like even now, yeah, Cornwall is seen as this. I mean, it is not in truth, but you know that is just kind of like the cliche about that particular part of the country is that. Everyone's a farmer. They've all got a combine harvester, and you know, they're all a little stupid.
Right, and indeed, Bob Acres, his main role is to kind of be kind of goofy, in a gentle, good-hearted way. But he is the butt of a lot of I'm dumb jokes, I guess. There's a scene in which he puts on a wig. And dances, and he talks about how he won't dance the minuet because he's got good English legs, and I don't know whether it's horrifying or reassuring to see this kind of redneck humor existed for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah, and in fact, it's worth pointing out that this is like this play is from around the time that that America had decided that they didn't want the king in charge of them anymore. So, you know, it's also a very important point where there was a lot of rivalry with the French court. So generally, if you were in the upper classes and you wanted to be seen as like in, you would take on the affectations of the French court, which is why Bob Acres has, you know, the pale white skin and the huge wig and, you know, all of that, because he's essentially trying to keep up with the fashions. You know, whereas the other characters that are kind of a bit more secure, they stay dressed as English gentlemen rather than trying to look French.
But you know, I also recall that that Falkland, when he hears what Julia has been up to in his absence, becomes particularly incensed when he hears that she has been engaging in country dancing.
Yes,
he says he would understand it if it were a minuet, but country dancing. So I'm not sure what that's code for. I guess it's code for something to do with sex. I don't know.
No, I think it's just simply that she's been dancing with people. I don't think there's ever any insinuation that either of the two main couples have been cheating on each other in any way. I think it's just that they've been seen out and about in town, you know, and that's what Julia has been doing. She hasn't been under house arrest, so she's been naturally, you know, out and about dancing in Falkland's absence. And I think Falkland is also himself is trying to, he's not going to wear a wig, but he's growing his hair in the French style. And he's getting his hair ready to have some curls put in so that he can look fashionable.
Akers has come to Jack to complain that he has a rival for Lydia's affections, who is, of course, Ensign Beverly, the fictitious character that Jack has created. And this amuses Jack and Fag. And now, is Falkland in on this whole thing? I think he is too.
Yeah, I think at the beginning of the scene, you know, Absolute has filled him in. Fag obviously already knows because he's been part of the ruse, and then he fills Falkland in, saying, you know, like she knows me as Beverly. But yeah, Akers is the only one who, up until the final scene, has no idea. Because the ruse of Beverly is revealed to some more characters halfway through, and then Akers is kind of still gonna duel Beverly like right up to the end without realizing what's going on. But yeah, it's funny because there's a lot of people in this play who will complain to Absolute about Beverly to his face, and Absolute always kind of has a little fun with it. And kind of stokes the fires in some cases of people being jealous of him, but as Beverly.
Yeah, it occurs to me that I'm referring to him as Jack, and you're referring to him as Absolute. I just want to point that out to our. I want to point that out to our listeners who are confused as to what's going on here. We're talking about Jack Absolute, but also in the scene, Sir Anthony Absolute shows up and announces to Jack that he is arranging a marriage. Now, of course, he has just in the last act gone to visit Mrs. Malaprop, and the marriage he wants to propose is to Lydia. But this is one of the few times in the play that the audience knows something that Jack doesn't. And Jack refuses to marry because he thinks this is just some random woman that Sir Anthony has chosen for him. And this is a big deal because Anthony is going to cut him out off of his inheritance if he doesn't acquiesce to his demands.
Yeah, and he also gives him a very tight deadline of 6.5 hours before that he wants him to agree to this arranged marriage in the next 6 hours. Which I guess if you're agreeing to an arranged marriage, what difference does it make how quickly you agree to it? But yeah, and again, it's worth saying as well that the action of this entire play takes place essentially over that 6 hours. Like we start a little bit before that, but by the time we get to the end of this one day, all of the action will have resolved itself. It's a very action-packed day for these people. But yeah, Jack gets, like, after Sir Anthony has left, Jack gets very angry at Fag and starts kind of yelling and screaming. And then we get a weird kind of like echo of Lucy's scene where Fag almost tries to have his own little monologue, and which is kind of about the lesson of, you know, you shouldn't get angry at the next person you see just because someone has just made you angry. And then, of course, the next person he sees, he gets angry at. And in fact, never gets to finish his monologue because, you know, this errand boy keeps interrupting him. So he just yells and takes him off stage. You know, so it's kind of like, you know, once again, Fag is acting like Jack. Jack was all angry and vented, and so Fag does the same.
There is, by the way, a really short scene here between Lucy and O'Trigger, where she delivers the letter from Delia, which is actually from Mrs. Malaprop, that O'Trigger thinks is from Lydia. And it's a little creepy because O'Trigger wants to wants Lucy to take kisses back to his supposed love Lydia, and he's going to give them to her.
Yeah, I think I'm going to guess that in the first version of this play, this would have been one of the scenes where O'Trigger would have been even more stereotyped. And would have probably, this scene probably would have been even worse. Except that obviously O'Trigger has kind of been rewritten a little bit, so he's a little less. But still, I guess the joke comes that he's going to kiss Lucy and then she's going to kiss Lydia, or like this weird kind of transference thing that he's trying to get going, as though that really matters. But yeah, and then Lucy. Again, she kind of explains to... This is when Fag gets the upper hand, essentially, on Jack, because now he's told that Mrs. Malaprop has made an arrangement with Sir Anthony for Lydia to get together with Jack. So essentially, this is where the audience is essentially caught up on the fact that he will be his own rival. And also, just in case people weren't clear on what had happened up to this point, they straighten everything out so you know exactly what Jack doesn't know at this particular point.
The next act, Jack realizing that his father wants to set him up with the woman he's in love with, acquiesces to his father's demands, and he has to kind of like give in, and he's a little concerned that his father's going to be set aback by the fact that he had refused so adamantly, but now he's going to just give in.
Yeah, his acquiescence is quite funny because he's kind of like, you know, he comes in and he decides that he's going to go along with what his father said, and this just makes Sir Anthony angry that Jack would agree to something that he wanted him to agree to. But I guess that's exactly what Sir Anthony does, is he gets angry at every single thing that happens, regardless of whether it's what he wanted or what he didn't want. And then, obviously, for the audience, this sets up the knowledge that when we're obviously going to have Mrs. Malaprop and Sir Anthony and Lydia and Jack all in the same space, and yet Lydia knows him as Beverly, and so it's setting up the stakes of how will Jack pull this off, how will he kind of play the good son for his father, but then also play the romantic for Lydia, all while everyone is watching him. So I guess this is the point where we finally get some stakes in this, where you think as an audience member you're thinking, how is he going to do this, because that is obviously there's got to be something that's going to go wrong. Someone's going to find something out and the whole thing's going to come crumbling down. You know, what will the consequence be?
After he tells his dad he's going to marry the girl his father has chosen for him, Jack goes to visit Mrs. Malaprop and says that he has accepted his father's office, and she presents him with a letter from Ensign Beverly saying there's a rival, you're going to have to defeat him. And Jack says, oh, I've got an idea. Let Lydia run off with Ensign Beverly, and then I will rescue her from him, and everything will be okay. And then he goes into the next room and he presents himself as Ensign Beverly in disguise. If you follow that now, dear listener, that's where we're at with the plot.
Well, he does this funny thing of Mrs. Malaprop is like, I've got this letter from Ensign Beverly, and he says some terrible things about me, and he makes her read the letter out, and where she's being called, is he call her a she-dragon? Yeah, and so he's basically having Mrs. Malaprop insult herself in front of him with his own words from the letter that he wrote whilst pretending that he didn't write it. And like we say, on stage it plays out very easily. Explaining it makes it sound a lot more complex, but it's a funny scene because Mrs. Malaprop is there getting angry about stuff that's in this letter, and Jack obviously gets to see it, you know, happening. Stuff that he basically wrote about her, you know, being read out by her. He basically tells Mrs. Malaprop that he's who he is. He never lies to her in that way, but then he lies to Lydia and says that, oh, I've managed to fool your aunt into thinking that I am this other person. But, you know, I'm here and we're going to get through this and I'll figure a way out. And I think, is this where he proposes that they elope? Or
he tells Mrs. Malaprop, let Lydia run off with Beverly and then I will swoop in and rescue her. But then he says to Mrs. Malaprop, as a joke, introduce me as Ensign Beverly.
Yeah.
And so Mrs. Malaprop becomes an instrument in Jack's deception to Lydia to continue this idea. Now, Lydia sees Jack dressed as a captain, not as an ensign, but Jack explains it as, it's me, Beverly, I've dressed up to come here and fool everyone. It almost works.
Yeah, it's funny because it kind of works for one scene, and then when Sir Anthony enters, which I think is a couple of scenes later, it doesn't work anymore because Sir Anthony knows that his son is his son, and he corrects that, you know, and we get a very, like, a kind of very brief thing where Absolute tries to, like, hide his voice, tries to do, like, a croaking thing and tries to make it sound in a way to disguise his voice. Because Lydia, at this particular time, she's told this is Absolute, and so she kind of turns her back and refuses to look at him. And so, obviously, Absolute thinks that if he can do this voice as Jack, but then talk to her normally as Beverly, then he can kind of convince her. But it quickly falls apart. And this is when he reveals to everybody what he's been doing.
Again, it's a sequence, as you've said quite often, that sequence is the perfect example of something that works marvelously on stage that is confusing as all get out to read. because it requires staging. It requires that you see what the sight lines of everyone are. It requires this conceit that Lydia is so incensed that she won't look, and Jack doesn't want to speak because he knows that he can't maintain the ruse for his father who's there. And yet Lydia is not an idiot either. She says, why doesn't Mrs. Malaprop realize that this is not Ensign Beverly? Finally, that all comes to a head. Now, in between, there's one sequence here. There's one small scene between Akers and O'Trigger.
I was going to say, you've skipped over. There's a very brief scene just before we get to the kind of the ruse with Beverly and Mrs. Malaprop, where Julia and Falkland meet again, and they kind of have a reunion. And then they get into an argument, and then Julia leaves, and Falkland starts his like a little monologue about how he doesn't want to cause her any pain, and he's gonna, you know, kind of run away or something. He basically kind of gets all kind of wimpy and sad, and that's how that scene kind of finishes.
Right? Wasn't he wanted to test her love by saying that he was being stationed abroad or something like that?
Yeah.
And would she wait for him in that time or whatever?
I can't remember the exact subject of the quarrel. I just know that he deliberately says something to upset her, and then she's upset. And I don't know what he thought was going to happen, but that sets up, because obviously now we're going to start to get the setups for all the different duels that are going to happen, and that is one of the things that kind of pushes Falkland towards taking part in one of the duels. He's broken up with Julia, or Julia is currently arguing with him, and he's kind of just gonna try and test her once more.
I don't think it's an accident that you and I skipped over this, because it's not a particularly interesting scene. I read an introduction to this play that was kind of talking about its lasting interest and its lasting history, and they were saying that it's always these sequences where Sheridan tries to play it a little more straight, and here he's trying to write kind of more of a kind of a traditional romantic comedy, in the sense of a comedy about the different ways that the two lovers view their relationship, and the ways in which Falkland wants to test Julia by saying, if her heart breaks when I say I'm going away, then I know she loves me. Her heart breaks, then he says, I'm not going away. And she's like, why did you do that? It's kind of very standard rom-com-y stuff, and it's not a particularly interesting scene.
As a character, Falkland is kind of, he's literally just there to not be Jack Absolute, basically. And whereas Bob Akers kind of serves as a really good counterpart because he's kind of easily led and a bit stupid, Falkland just seems to be whining a lot, and it's not really. I mean, I can kind of, I think maybe it's because I know how, at this particular point, we know how this story will end and how Falkland Julia isn't, that storyline doesn't really resolve in a satisfying way. They just kind of stop arguing and get back together. And so it feels like all the build up throughout the play of that storyline is just essentially wasting time. And even when all the jewels get set up, it isn't really his part is the least compelling of all the different jewels that are gonna apparently happen.
Now, in the sequence where we discussed before, where Jack's deceit is discovered, and it goes down just about as well as you might expect with Lydia. She feels trifled with. She feels angry. She refuses both Jack and Beverly. She says, Anthony thinks that Lydia is angry because Jack has been too lively as Ensign Beverly.
It's funny because, like, Sir Anthony is trying to force Jack to marry a woman he wants to marry anyway, and Lydia is trying to marry a man that she wants to marry, but in protest. But yeah, all of that kind of gets swept to one side once the whole ruse has been revealed, and then the play kind of becomes about a load of people going to duels. I personally feel like that if that deception had been kept going until the very end, then the reveal would have been the climax. But as it is, the reveal is kind of the middle of the play, and everyone is kind of, Julia leaves in a huff, and Sir Anthony doesn't know what to do, and Mrs. Malaprop isn't really quite clear on what they're going to do, and it kind of feels like the middle of the play where everyone's like, well, I guess Lydia doesn't want to marry Jack anymore, or she was only marrying him because he was pretending to be poor, or there's kind of this weird point of where the plot kind of gets resolved halfway through the play. And I guess if you're watching it for the first time, you would get to this point and you'd think, oh, well, there must be only like, five more minutes left and then this will be all sorted out. But there's still quite a lot of the play left after that reveal is done.
I'm looking at my notes here, and I realize that after this sequence shows, Sir Lucius shows up and challenges Jack to a duel. And I remember Akers be challenging Beverly to a duel, but I gather that Lucius challenges Jack, qua Jack, to a duel as well.
Yeah, I think Akers is rejected by Lydia, and so he challenges Ensign Beverly, and he asks Absolute to be his second, which leads to the funny thing where Absolute is like, I don't think in this particular circumstance I could be your second, which obviously is a little bit of a kind of play on language there. But yeah, but then Lucius Trigger, he eggs Bob Akers into this challenge and kind of makes him, kind of gets him riled up, ready for it, without telling him that it might lead to his death. And then this is the point at which Sir Lucius says that he also will challenge Beverly, but then I think there's a couple of scenes later where he also challenges Jack. So he plans to watch Akers duel Beverly, and if Akers dies, he will then duel Beverly, and then once he's done with his duel with Beverly, he will then, if he's still alive, duel with Jack. And that's, so Lucius Trigger just wants a duel basically with someone. And so he's essentially lined himself up these two different duels, but he's also lined Bob Acres up with the duel as well. But we are in the position where Jack is going to be both dueling with himself and against himself at some point. It's set up very kind of. There's a few short scenes where they set each of these duels up very quickly, and the dialogue is very funny, and Lucius O'Trigger is very funny, and Bob Acres is very funny. Everyone's very funny, and there's a lot of back and forth. But it kind of just end. You end up in the situation where there's even a thing where Jack is like, "Can we?" Or is it? I think it's Lucius O'Trigger is like, "Well, can we change the venue of this particular duel, the one with Jack?" Because I've got more business elsewhere that might keep me until six, he says. And so it's basically like, let's just get all the jewels in one place so I can get it all out of the way in one go. I don't want to have to be going around Bath in different jewels with different people, which of course is what is one of the things that will bring everyone in the play to this one location, is the fact that Lucio Sartrigger is like, yeah, let's have everything happen in this one particular spot, which is Kingsmead Field, which is... setting up the last scene, basically.
There's a bit of some comedy here where Lucius is supposed to be giving Acres encouragement by stepping him through what to do in a duel, and it's of course only making Acres more and more terrified. O'Trigger pulls out a gun and aims it at Acres, and Acres turns sideways and he says, "That's no good. It'll go through any vital organs it hits. It'll hit on the other side as well." And he tells him to turn and present his broadside.
And also there's talk of, you know, where to stand so that the light is good and how many paces to take. And, Bob is like, this is when they take the kind of 10 paces, he's like, this is way too close. It's got to be a lot further away. And there's a lot of discussion about proper kind of dueling etiquette, essentially, and where you stand and which weapon you pick and everything. Which again is just Sheridan kind of parodying the idea that duels are a good idea, or that they are in any way like a useful way to settle any kind of feud.
And also Jack at one point has a sword that he says he's going to use to die a romantic death if Lydia doesn't change her mind. It's really this last thing is kind of this extended. Satire on the whole idea of this being any kind of a way for anyone to act, and that there's anything particularly romantic about dueling or dying for love.
And before all the ladies join the men at Kingsmead Field, there is a scene where Julia and Lydia are trying to decide who has the worst relationship. and each of them is saying that they are in a worse situation and how terrible they are, and it's quite kind of funny because they're each trying to it kind of reminds me of the Monty Python, although not originally Monty Python, Four Yorkshiremen sketch where they're trying to say who has the worst childhood, and it's kind of my relationship is terrible because he deceived me and told me he was this, and my relationship is terrible because he tested me by doing this, and they kind of do this for a few minutes before they kind of get interrupted with people telling them that that both of their lovers are going to be shot in a duel, so they should probably get to that.
I don't think anyone watching this play is ever going to actually feel tense, but he's building up sort of the excitement and the confusion as to what happens, because what happens is basically once the women and Sir Anthony show up, the balloon sort of deflates and everyone just sort of decides, well, let's not have a duel after all.
Yeah, there is a very, very funny scene that probably the funniest part of the play, which is when Fag and Malaprop and everyone arrives and they're trying to tell Lydia about the duel. And they both keep saying in the most long-winded way, we should tell you this quickly. And they're like, this is very important. I've really got to tell you this quickly because it's the essence of time. We've got to get this done fast. And each time they don't say what's actually happening, they just keep telling her that it's such urgent news. They need to tell them quickly. It's the last kind of bit of like full out comedy in the play where characters are acting in a really funny way. But it also kind of, at that point, it does kind of start to diffuse some of the tension because you're like, well, if this is so if someone's going to die, why are these people spending 5 minutes standing around telling someone?
So the play kind of resolves with everyone coming to their senses, Lydia and Julia forgiving their respective lovers and getting back together. And then O'Trigger pulls out his letters from Delia and says, well, what about me? What's going on here? Who are these? Didn't Lydia write these to me? And this is where Mrs. Malaprop pops up and says, oh, actually, those were mine. And I have to say, I was really disappointed here because I thought there was going to be some more payoff other than simply O'Trigger just kind of reacts with horror at the idea of having fallen in love with an older woman. And they're quite cruel to her for no good reason.
Yeah, I think it's just one of those things where, I mean, it's worth noting as well that Sir Lucius O'Trigger kind of himself triggers everybody stopping the duel when he explains to Bob Acres, he's like, what do you want me to do in the event of an accident? And Bob Acres is like, well, what is an accident? He's like, well, if you're dead, you know, if you're dying, I can't really get any instruction of if you want to be, I can't remember what he says. He says about embalming.
Do you want to be pickled?
Yes, pickled.
Do you want to be pickled and taken home? Or do you want to be taken up to the church there?
Yeah, buried in the abbey, I think he says. And yeah, so, and I think it's at that point that Bob Acres is like, well, hold on a second. I don't want to be pickled and I certainly don't want to be buried in the abbey. So let's not have this duel. But yeah, it does just kind of, all the characters are on stage and it just kind of finishes with people being a little bit cruel to Mrs. Malaprop at the end. And then Lucy gives the epilogue speech and then that's kind of the end of it. But yeah, it does kind of just fizzle out, which is a little bit disappointing because I think that Sheridan is, you know, I guess his strength doesn't lie in his plotting. It lies in his language and his characters. So it's a little disappointing that they don't get to, like, no one. I mean, it would have been nice if someone accidentally, like, fired a gun in the air or something, or accidentally stabbed someone, like, something to kind of at least tie that whole storyline up. But in the end, it just kind of stops, and that's the end of the play. I think. Maybe if they hadn't have had like a poor opening and if they hadn't have had to rewrite it, maybe Sheridan would have been a bit more confident in the ending. But I feel like the kind of the outside factors of the poor reception of the play maybe made him a little bit more cautious of doing anything at the end. So yeah, it is a little bit disappointing because, you know, as we said, once they set everything up in the first act, this play moves very quickly and everything kind of gets swirled around so fast and plot lines get, you know, thrown left and right and characters are kind of telling each other stuff and hiding stuff. And every, you know, Bob Acres is literally the last person in the play to know that Ensign Beverly is his close friend, you know, which is only revealed when basically Jack Absolute like hugs him and says, look, it's me. I'm Ensign Beverly, like directly to him, just to make it clear that, you know, he's not gonna have to duel with him. I mean, I really enjoyed the play up until this final act. This is always the bit that kind of bothered me, was this last kind of 5 minutes.
At this point in the podcast, we normally talk about this from the standpoint of returning to the play. I can't talk about it as a return because this is my first time reading this play, but I did want to say that I had a lot of the same responses to the play that you had, which are enjoying it up till the end. The other thing I would say that I found a little interesting is whenever you read Shakespeare or whenever you see a Shakespeare play, I think there's about a 10 or 15 minute moment where you're kind of acclimating yourself to the world of this language. And then after that, you're just kind of in it and it works. I found this oddly a little bit more difficult to get into, even though this is much more modern language. Something about this late 18th century prose just was a bit odd for me. Maybe it's a little easier for an English reader. It occurs to me that this is, of course, the point at which our various language traditions are diverging. If you go back to Shakespeare's time, that was at the beginning of the English colonization of the Americas. And so up to that point, we share the same language. But by this point, the two traditions have split enough that it's recognizably alien to me.
Well, I mean, that's interesting because I wouldn't say I had... I mean, obviously, you know, when I read this play, I was a lot younger. When I saw the performance with Hyacinthe Bouquet as Mrs. Malaprop, you know, she was essentially billed as the star of that because... And I even feel like they emphasized her a lot more in that particular production because she was so well known, and so that was kind of the focus. And obviously the fact that, like, you know, some of the malapropisms, like you said, were a little bit harder for you to figure out what she was trying to say, possibly because they're more well known phrases over here still. And I would like to think that the obviously the language hasn't changed that much in the last kind of like 200 and something years. But I think that the thing as well is Sheridan is almost writing with like he's deliberately writing in a way that wasn't the style of the time. Like people who were speaking in 1775 in England weren't talking like these characters in any way. Like it's a deliberately stagey language. The way that characters talk to each other is, like we say, they give a lot of exposition at certain points, and so they will talk in a way that is kind of a little bit odd. And I think, you know, it is a little bit of probably a little bit harder to get into than kind of, you know, stuff from like the last 100 years. But I mean, maybe it's just because I was familiar with the play. It didn't seem especially difficult. I think the first scene where they're given all the information, you kind of figure out how people are going to talk and the way they're going to talk. And then when you start to see, because each character has a slightly different way of speaking to the audience and to each other. So I think there's a little bit of that where it's kind of, particularly the fact that it ends with an epilogue where someone is like, well, did you like the play? It feels as if the characters on stage are deliberately putting on a play for you to watch sometimes. Like the fact that Jack is doing this really kind of convoluted whole Ensign Beverly thing, and whenever he meets a new character, he's like, "Oh, I'm playing Ensign Beverly, but I'm also Jack Absolute." And I feel like maybe there's at least one step removed from it being, you know, the language of 1775 England at least. But it is true, obviously, that, you know, this would have been around the time that Americans would start to speak American rather than English.
I will say this about the play. I enjoyed it, but as you say, it seemed highly theatrical to me, and both as you point out in the way that the characters speak and the way that the characters sort of self-consciously give exposition, but the basic plot and its concerns with misidentity, with its concerns with issues of class and who has the power in any given scene, it seems very solidly stock, kind of like what you would expect a play from this time to be about, but also comfortably fits into the overall string of British theater. So it kind of, after I finished it, it reminded me sort of in an odd way of like a well-constructed 90s rom-com in that,
yeah,
it fulfills expectations.
Yeah. I guess, I think it's interesting because, like, a lot of, say, like, the Restoration comedy, no one ever performs these days. Like, no one, I think there's maybe one or two plays out of, say, 200 or 300 that even survived that time because they were generally seen to be terrible in every way. Like, they were poorly written, they were poorly acted, they were poorly staged. Everything about them was terrible. Whereas plays from this period of time, like you say, you know, She Stoops to Conquer and some of the others that were written around this kind of period just before the end of the 1700s, they are still performed today. Like I said, I saw a production a couple of decades ago, and the one that's on YouTube is from only like 10 years ago. So they are still performed today. And I think the reason they're performed today is because They do seem kind of like what you would expect, you know, people. I guess the funniest thing is, I think the best example of this is Blackadder the Third, where like everything that you think about when you think about the kind of the Georges, the George the First, Second, Third, that kind of that predominated over the 1700s all the way through into the 1800s, all that time period of what you think it is kind of in this play, like the way that people, you know, had kind of frivolous concerns about going to Bath to balance out their bile and all this kind of stuff. It's kind of reflected in this play of, you know, here are a couple of servants, here are some wealthy people, and they're, you know, the biggest concern that Lydia Langwish has is whether she can hide her books from her aunt. She's not got the weight of the world on her shoulders. She, you know, she's going to the trouble of deliberately marrying a poor person so that she'll lose her inheritance. Which I think is something we haven't mentioned, is everyone in this, like the four kind of main romantic leads all have inheritances that are at stake. And I feel like Sir Lucius O'Trigger, he says at one point that he's poor, and that he's basically just looking for a rich woman to marry, because although he's got the title, he doesn't have the money that comes with it. And that's kind of like, you know, that's something that you think that this period is all about, is people, super rich people, being concerned with who to marry. And that was even true of like the royalty at the time, you know, like the different houses in Europe at this particular time were either marrying each other or fighting each other, you know, and concerning themselves with taking over countries around the world, you know, or losing those colonies to certain wars. So it's funny because this play has no hint of anything going on outside the world of Bath for this one kind of afternoon. It's like a very narrow play, but it made Sheridan money, and it you know, it restored his fortune for the next kind of 5 years. And he was remarkably, like, in the next 5 years he did like 7 plays. You know, he I think he kind of gathered, you know, he figured out how to do plays better, and he kind of churned them out, and then he went off to Parliament and never wrote another play again. And he died in debt. Though I understand America was willing to give him some money because he supported them when he was in Parliament. So, you know, the Continental Congress were willing to send some money back home for him so he could have like a decent old age, but he refused the money and died kind of in poverty, basically. But yeah, I think it's what you, like you say, this play is stock. You know, you've got the country bumpkin, you've got the person who's stupid, you've got the romantic lead. It's interesting that the character of Jack Absolute, there are some novels that have been written in recent years using that character as like the hero of them. I guess because, you know, calling your character Jack, Phil, is, I mean, his second name may as well be an Everyman, because that's what it feels like. He doesn't, you know, he's always right, and he always gets his way, and he never really has any trouble, which I think kind of sums up most of the characters in this play, is, you know, they don't really have troubles, they're just more concerned about deciding who they're going to marry. But I guess for Sheridan it was a little personal, because obviously he married for love. These characters, yeah, they're trying to marry for love. So there's a little bit of his kind of personal life seeps in there. And certainly when I was writing a number of essays for my A-levels, that was one of the main themes that we talked about, was that these are characters who want to marry for love, but in the end they marry for money. But they kind of convince themselves that they married for love.
Thanks to co-host Darren Husted. Darren is the producer behind several podcasts, including A Talking Cast, The Cast Next Door, and As If. His new podcast, I've Made a Huge Mistake, is all about Arrested Development. You can find all these podcasts on iTunes. Thanks to Christy Admiral for reading the part of Mrs. Malaprop. You can find Christy's writing on thetoast.net and The Mary Sue. Do you like Beverly Clary? Sure, we all do. Why don't you check out Cricketcast, a Beverly Clary podcast hosted by Phil Gonzalez and me, also available from the Incomparable Network. Speaking of the Incomparable Network, why don't you head over to theincomparable.com and check out some of Sophomore Lit's sister podcasts. Also, join us on Facebook or write to us at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. And as always, everything will be on the final.